It's the Security Weekly News, take two, episode 301. I'm Doug White, and it is Friday, the 26th of May, 2023. We've got ferret legging, Elon's brain implants, Volt Typhoon, Cosmic Energy, OAuth, I Love You, and that's not just the Molly talking, and more on this episode of the Security Weekly News.
This is a Security Weekly production for security professionals by security professionals. Please visit securityweekly.com/subscribe to subscribe to all the shows on our network.
We interrupt our program to bring you this important message.
It's the show that keeps you up to date on the latest security news twice a week. Your trusted source for accurate security information and expert analysis. It's time for Security Weekly News.
Did you know that Active Directory is exploited in 9 out of 10 cyber attacks? With access to Active Directory, attackers can gain control of your network. To keep attackers out, you need to find and fix Active Directory security gaps. Meet Purple Knight, a free security assessment tool that scans your environment for hundreds of vulnerabilities and helps you fix the problems. Ready to reduce your Active Directory attack surface? Download Purple Knight, the number one Active Directory security vulnerability assessment tool. Visit securityweekly.com/Semperis, S-E-M-P-E-R-I-S, for more information.
Hi, folks. I'm Adrian Sanabria, the host of Enterprise Security Weekly. Every week, we interview the most interesting folks we can find, talking about the most pressing cybersecurity issues and challenges facing the enterprise today. Myself and my co-hosts have each been in the industry for decades, long enough to see the patterns in the industry and explore where trends are going. In addition to enterprise challenges, we also follow the vendor space, the most interesting security startups emerging, technology and product trends, all of the most interesting funding and acquisition announcements. Finally, we love to discuss the latest trends in tech and how they'll impact cybersecurity. If you're wondering how the latest in AI, quantum computing, cloud, and DevOps is going to impact security a few years down the road, you should follow the Enterprise Security Weekly podcast.
All right. It is Security Weekly News. We didn't get hacked by Paul's Security Weekly, although it kind of looked that way, but we didn't. They're not capable of that stuff anymore. But it is Memorial Day weekend in the United States, so special thanks to all of our friends who served in the military, like my dad and a bunch of my uncles, and of course, Aaron Leyland and everybody else who made sure that we could go on the air and say whatever the hell we wanted to, for the most part, except in Florida. But, you know, let's not get into that. All right. Volt Typhoon is a Chinese, speaking of authoritarian empires, Volt Typhoon is a Chinese spy group that is being tracked by Microsoft. And Microsoft says they've been targeting critical infrastructure organizations across the United States, including Guam, which is strangely specific. You know, it's like including Guam. But if you don't know about Guam, Guam is the location of a bunch of U.S. military bases, so kind of makes sense. According to Microsoft, the attacks have been being seen since at least mid-2021, and the report says that they believe that Volt Typhoon is pursuing development of capabilities that could disrupt critical communications infrastructure between the United States and Asia during a potential crisis. And China is nothing if not forward-thinking. I mean, that's a Chinese thing. Play the long game. Always be ready. I took all this to mean Taiwan. You know, since the days of Chiang Kai-shek and Sun Yat-sen, Taiwan has been a thorny issue for the Chinese government, and Taiwan is a U.S. ally that the People's Republic of China does not recognize as an independent state, and so there's always been a lot of saber rattling in the Taiwan Strait between U.S. forces and Chinese forces and Taiwanese forces and so forth. A lot of that, you know, I was inverted kind of stuff. You remember that from the old Top Gun? Yeah. Well, Volt Typhoon has been compromising internet-exposed Fortinet FortiGuard devices using some unknown zero-day vulnerability. They did not release what that might be. After gaining access through the Fortinet device, they use what Microsoft calls living off the land or LOL attacks, which I thought was funny. See what I did there? LOL attacks and LOL binaries. Like PowerShell, which they called LOL bins, like PowerShell, certutil, NetSH, WMIC to operate in that network. They also use fast reverse proxy, Mimikatz, Impacket, or I think they actually say Impacket, and so forth. But all of this was documented in a joint advisory from the FBI, NSA, CISA, and Five Eyes partner cybersecurity agencies from Australia, New Zealand, and the UK and Canada. After the break-in, primarily what they're doing is looking for credentials, so a classic Mimikatz operation. They grab the credentials, which then allows them to exfiltrate data and maintain persistence in these critical infrastructure networks. Now, much like Russia did in the Ukraine, the development of a potential conflict between the United States and China over Taiwan would likely involve a lot of this kind of exploitation as an advance and, of course, ongoing attack if such hostilities did emerge. Like I said, that is a very Chinese concept of, you know, being prepared and planning way, way, way ahead. So always expect the long game from China, and who knows what will happen there. Mandiant said that a new piece of malware that appears to be linked to Russia is specifically designed to target ICS, and in particular, electrical grid ICS. So, sound familiar? Yeah. So, you know, we got the Taiwan Strait on one side of the world. We've got Russia on the other side. The malware that they're using is called Cosmic Energy, and it was designed to interact with IEC 6870-5-104 devices. The malware sends remote commands that tamper with the actuation of power line switches and circuit breakers in an effort to cause power disruptions. And we've seen this from Russia before. We saw this in the Ukraine. We've seen it in other. We saw it in Belarus and so forth. Mandiant said it, quote, poses a plausible threat to affected electric grid assets. The IEC 6870-5-104, don't you love how that just rolls off the tongue? ICS people don't have marketing. But anyway, the IEC 6080-5-104 is a protocol for telco functions that power electric power systems. So this is all these actuators and switches and things, and it's a communications protocol. Cosmic Energy can use this to interact with remote terminal units, or RTUs, which are commonly used in electric transmission and distribution. And this particular set is primarily in Europe, the Middle East, and Asia. The first part of the malware has been called Lightwork, and it uses the 104 protocol. I'm just going to shorten it to that. The 104 protocol to modify the RTU to being in a state of on or off. So they can flip these things on and off. And of course, what these actuators may do, you know, depends on the purpose. They also then use another tool called PyHop, which connects to a specific remote MS SQL server for uploading files and issuing remote commands to the RTU using Lightwork. So they got these two pieces working together. Cosmic Energy does require that credentials be obtained to get on the system, which is probably not that hard. And the attacker must then gather all the IP addresses and such manually. So a lot of reconnaissance type attacking going on in that. So it's not just a wide open attack like the Chinese one on the FortiGuard stuff. But the malware may be the result of a contracted development for red teaming exercises back in 2021 or 2022, according to Mandiant. So if you are developing red teaming software, you know, protect it. But it can certainly be repurposed. We all need to protect our infrastructure very carefully, because you want to watch civilization break down, wait until the power fails for a long time. It goes from everybody having avocado toast and soy whip lattes mit Schlager to the Lord of the Flies and me barbecuing somebody's toes on a spit pretty fast. So, you know, this is definitely scary stuff. Attackers are now using encrypted RP message attachments, RPMSG messages, to avoid detection by all the email gateways everybody has set up now. These attachments are being sent using compromised Microsoft 365 accounts to steal more Microsoft credentials in phishing attacks, which are difficult to detect. So they basically compromise somebody's account. They use that as a baseline to send you something from the owner of the company or the CEO or the CISO or whomever. As Microsoft's move toward a sort of all-encompassing single sign-on, which if you use Microsoft 365, you've noticed that all of your Office stuff, all your email stuff, everything else is, you know, all one single sign-on. You basically now on your local machine, your work account, and everything else, you're using the same credentials. So the focus on obtaining those credentials has increased and become more important. Restricted permission message files, which are called RPMSGs, are encrypted. And these attachments that they use and use that particular tool to encrypt themselves, which are encrypted using Microsoft Rights Management Services. And that means that a typical email gateway filter that is looking at attachments cannot read the contents and subsequently detect a phishing message. In order to read these messages, you have to log into your Microsoft account, and then obtain a one-time code to decrypt a file. So this is how it's supposed to work. It's kind of like MIME in a way, or S-MIME anyway. The example in the article was an email from a compromised Microsoft 365 account, which came from Talus Pay, which is a legitimate company that does billing and so forth. And it was sent to the billing department of another company that they didn't name and showed an attached encrypted message. The email asks you to read the message by clicking a button to decrypt, as you might expect, and that's how it works normally. The decryption, of course, then asks you to sign into your Microsoft account. Yeah. So something that, you know, we all do, we see this all the time. But once you do this, the message decrypts, and you get sent to a fake SharePoint document, which has a click here to view this document button. This, of course, is, you know, every one of these steps is allowing things to happen. All this results in you ending up on an empty page that has a loading wait screen on it. So while you're waiting and listening to the da 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 da, you know, kind of music, I don't think there's any music, but there should be. Well, while you're waiting, the script gathers a bunch of stuff from your local system, like your visitor ID, your connection token and hash, the video card renderer information, the system language, and all kinds of identifying components that probably allow them to further tailor some of this stuff. But it gathers all that up. It then displays a Microsoft 365 login form, which looks just like the one you've already done, and asks you to re-enter your credentials, which you probably do. And then it sends those credentials to the attacker. So with all that information, they can profile you and see what kind of person you are, where you're located, and see if it's going to be valuable to pursue. The only real advice here is you need to warn your users about these kind of attachments and that basically everything is a scam. I mean, it also advises you should be using multi-factor, which we've been telling you for years, to try to prevent these kind of credential attacks from being reusable, you know, because somebody is going to click the link. I mean, let's just face it. Somebody will click this. Salt Security said that OAuth-related vulnerabilities in the Framework Expo could have been exploited to take control of user accounts. Expo, if you are unawares, is an open source platform for developing universal native apps for mobile devices and websites. The product is in use by, according to them, more than 600,000 developers and several major companies currently. So OAuth itself is a tool set which is provided by Expo, and it allows developers to do something we all have seen quite a bit lately, user authentication through third-party services like Facebook and Google. So anytime you see those things where they pop up and it says, would you like to log in with your Google account or your Facebook account, that kind of thing. The analysis by Salt said that they had found security flaws which have been exploited or could have been exploited by getting the users to click on specially crafted links that would allow the hijacking of the session or even full control of the user's account. In other cases, it allowed the attackers to actually perform actions on behalf of the users on Facebook, Google, Twitter, and anything that allows this kind of punch through. It's a very API attack kind of thing. The vulnerabilities were reported to Expo in mid-February, and Expo says they were quickly addressed. Expo does have a blog post that is linked in the article, if you want to read it, that details how you can try to prevent this exploitation. Salt did go on to say that that only implementations which use the auth session proxy of the social login component of Expo were affected by that. But that hundreds of potentially impacted services, including Code Academy, were out there currently. Expo said they did not have evidence of an actual breach in the wild or exploitation in the wild at this time. Salt Security also found the OAuth vulnerabilities back on earlier this year on Booking.com. So they've really been focused on this lately. Well, in the big book of I Hope Your E&O Insurance is Paid Up, Practice First Medical Management Solutions and PBS MedCode will pay the state of New York $550,000 after they fail to apply quote, timely apply a patch to a known vulnerability. So this is an awfully good, painful lesson for you. The failure to patch led to a breach which impacted over 1.2 million individuals, with 428,000 of them residing in New York, where this lawsuit was filed. As usual, so they did reach a settlement. As usual, the settlement's going to require Practice First to, quote, bolster its data security practices and provide the affected consumers with the ubiquitous free credit monitoring services. And I always say, I think I've got a couple of lifetimes worth of credits on these things now from all the breaches that I've been subject to. Practice First is a data processing, billing, and coding service provider for healthcare. Similar enforcements like this have now been issued to Meta, Google, Premom, iMed, and MedEvolve, all very recently, and they have had similar enforcement actions taken just this month. So, you know, keep your premiums paid up, and, you know, maybe when you're doing support for these companies as a third party, you may want to check patches and so forth before you say everything's good. I mean, we've all been there, so really, patch up. On May 5th in 2000, I was working in my lab in Colorado, and I saw some of the earliest craziness that was a predictor of some of what was going to happen later. Every server in the entire world suddenly was sitting on your desk in the basement of the Monfort building in Colorado. And on that day, we saw the first incidents with the I Love You worm. This thing was also called Love Bug, or a Love Letter For You worm. And it infected more than 10 million Windows machines within a few days. And in 2000, that was a lot. There was a very large portion of stuff that was connected. So it was a massive problem. Pretty much everybody was getting blasted by this thing, including Ford Motor, AT&T, Microsoft, the Pentagon, the Army, the United Kingdom Parliament, and my email server right there in Colorado. The point of this story being here was, and it is about an ancient worm, but it was to illustrate that humans have always been the weakest link in the chain. I mean, I knew that. I mean, I learned that war dialing people back in the 1980s, you know, say the right thing, boom, I'm in. I mean, this has worked since the first Roman bought a winning ticket in the Gallia lottery on the pier at Caesarea. And the point is that 23 years later, it still works. Or in the case of the pier at Caesarea, 2,043 years later. But, you know, so maybe read this. I don't know that this particular story was best suited for your users, but I think you could maybe use it as a basis for a history lesson or something to disprove your point about clicking on things. I mean, even if it's from the grandkids and it says, I love you, Daddy, it may be a scam. You know, I mean, I remember having that conversation with my parents. You know, it was just like the early internet sit down and explain the world to them. It was sort of the birds and bees of the internet. You know, like, you know, Dad, just because your best friend sends you a message that says, I love you, doesn't mean you should click on it. You know, and my dad was like, they would never do that. And I'm like, well, you know, be cynical, people. Come on, be cynical. Well, Krebs had a pretty good article interviewing a crypto scam investment spammer, which I thought I would share with you. It almost sounds like a kitchen tool that Gordon Ramsay would use in a demo and just assume everybody has, you know, get out your kitchen crypto spammer tool, you know, and you're like, what the hell is that? But anyway, they basically in this article focused on Mastodon and a spam attack on various Mastodon components, which occurred on the 4th of May, using direct messaging on the platform. The focus was on a crypto trading platform called MoonexTrade.co, and it used more than 1,500 internet addresses across 400 providers to rapidly register new accounts on Mastodon such that they had to shut down new accounts. And then it followed those popular accounts on Mastodon that were already there and was able to send private mentions, which is what Mastodon calls instant messaging, to other people that were following those very popular sites. Anyway, it's a really interesting article about how they talked about how they hunted down the people who were involved in this and all the domain registrants that use this name. And they finally chased it down to an Austrian phone number belonging to someone named Sergei Prushatinsky. But, you know, it was really interesting, and it was an elaborate Mastodon attack that only resulted in about $2,000 in profits, but the FBI estimated that losses from cryptocurrency scams last year was the largest cybercrime loss in 2022, and it netted around $2.57 billion in losses with a B. That was up from $907 million in losses in 2021, which is a 184% year-over-year increase. It also could just be an increase in reporting, though, so they didn't really analyze it that way. But regardless of that, it is a big deal, so you might want to read through that article. Well, after an early life interest as a ferret legger, as you know, being a profession, he was forced out of the sport after a debilitating injury, only to return as one of the top UK boffins on cyber. Please welcome Aaron Leyland.
Hey, Dr. Doug. Welcome back from Chicago.
Thank you.
You're happy to be back and in the seat after the 300th episode this week.
I'm telling you, that was awesome to have the 300th episode come up. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah, I'm very impressed by that. It's a shame the days are gone when we did more of this in the studio together, but one day maybe.
You bet.
Okay, right. I'll get straight into this because it's pretty quick fire. Okay, so this has been reported all over the news in the last couple of days, and very rightly so. A scientific breakthrough has enabled a paralyzed man to walk again, thanks to the power of artificial intelligence and a wireless digital bridge. So the story revolves around Gert Jan Oskam, a man who was paralyzed in a cycling accident a decade ago. So through the use of a wireless digital link, a remarkable transformation has taken place, allowing him to regain his ability to walk. The advancements in technology have created a communication channel between Gert Jan's brain and spinal cord, re-establishing the connection that was lost due to his injury. You can see a video of this, of him standing, walking, and even climbing stairs if you follow the link in the show notes. His movements may be slow, but significantly, he's in control. So by harnessing the power of his thoughts and intentions to walk, these impulses are translated into action. The breakthrough had a liberating effect on Gert Jan's life. Not only can he move his legs again, but he can now choose to stand up from his wheelchair and enjoy a drink with his friends at the bar, like most of us take for granted. The psychological importance of being able to interact with others at their eye level should definitely not be underestimated. The key to this revolutionary development lies in the application of artificial intelligence, GO AI. Brain-computer interfaces implanted just above the movement control center in Gert Jan's brain relay nerve signals to a computer through the power of AI. The computer deciphers the relevant signals, effectively decoding Gert Jan's intent. These instructions are then transmitted wirelessly to a second implant located in Gert Jan's lower back, which were severely damaged nerves in his neck are bridged. Electrical signals are carefully sequenced to stimulate the leg muscles in the correct order, allowing him to walk once again. It's important to recognize the pivotal role played by artificial intelligence in this achievement. Over a decade ago, researchers in the United States were already working on decoding signals to control robotic arms. The challenge there lay in identifying patterns within the vast amount of data to determine intent. The Swiss researchers have succeeded in training their AI system to discern the specific signals that matter when Gert Jan contemplates a particular muscle movement. Okay, the implications of this breakthrough are profound, really. The technology has proven to be transformational for Gert Jan, restoring his ability to walk, and now the focus shifts to making the technology available to a larger population of individuals paralyzed by accidents or strokes. However, there's always a however, isn't there? It must be acknowledged that cost and accessibility will be key considerations. Hopefully this incredible advancement will not be limited to the wealthy, those with lots of Bitcoin, or those with the correct insurance coverage. I've looked a bit deeper into it, so you don't have to. At its core, a BCI detects and interrupts electrical or neurophysiological signals generated by the brain. These signals are then translated into meaningful commands or actions. The process involves several stages, which I'll break down. We start with signal acquisition. BCIs employ various sensors to capture brain signals. The most common method is non-invasive, thank God. Probes in the brain. Using the electrodes placed in the scalp to measure electrical activity. These electrodes picked up, right, wait for this, electroencephalogram, hopefully I've said that properly, Doug will tell me at the end, EEG signals which reflect the collective electrical behavior of brain cells. The acquired brain cells are raw and contain a vast amount of information. Well, some people's do. Signal processing techniques come into play to filter, amplify, and extract relevant features from the signals. This step is crucial for improving signal quality and extracting meaningful patterns. I'm sure not all people's brains have meaningful patterns, at least not most people that I've ever worked with. So after processing, specific features are extracted from the brain signals. These features are carefully chosen to represent essential patterns or characteristics related to the user's intentions or commands. For instance, in motor imagery BCIs, features might include changes in the frequency or amplitude of specific EEG rhythms. I'm not going to try and say the word again. Associated with imagined movements. And then the next step is classification. A classification algorithm or machine learning model is employed. The algorithm learns from previously recorded brain activity, typically using supervised learning techniques. The model is trained to associate patterns of brain activity with specific commands or actions. During real-time operation, the model predicts the user's intention based on the extracted features. The predicted intention or command from the BCI system is used to control the external device. This can involve a wide range of actions, and I did so much research on this today, I fell in the right rabbit hole, but such as moving a cursor on a screen, controlling a robotic arm, or even gathering text on a computer screen. They say that feedback is a vital component of BCIs, where it provides information to the user about the success or accuracy of their commands. Visual, auditory, or haptic feedback can be utilized, allowing users to learn and adapt their brain pattern activities to improve the performance of the BCI. So when we put it all together, a BCI system integrates signal acquisition, are you listening? Processing, feature extraction, classification, action execution, and feedback mechanisms, establishing a powerful communication channel between the human brain and the external devices. Possibilities are endless. This is all, it's all like Star Wars and Star Trek and New Frontiers anyway in neuroscience. Truly awe-inspiring. Okay, back to you in the studio, Dr. Doug, who is a man that cannot be improved by AI alone.
Thank you, Aaron. And finally, speaking of that, what Aaron was just talking about, it's over now. Elon Musk, and I'm not a Luddite, mind you. I'm just mad at Elon because he promised me a Tesla X and he never delivered. But Elon Musk got approval from the Food and Drug Administration to human trials on Neuralink, Musk's brain implant venture. Just the fact that you're saying Elon Musk's brain implant venture sounds pretty scary to me. But the venture, and like I said, I'm not really a Luddite. The venture is trying to surgically implant a device using that a robot does. And this is not a little something on your head. This is actually put into your brain. And it will actually decode human brain activity, just like this the tool that Aaron was talking about. It will decode your brain activity and link it to a computer, which means you could, you know, literally control a computer with your brain, kind of like what we were just talking about. Animal research has been conducted so far, and you know, but don't worry about things like an army of spider monkeys marching towards you. Nothing to see here, and they're all being controlled by Elon and Twitter. But I mean, you know, I love the idea of having a USB port put in my forehead by Elon Musk, because you know, what could go wrong with that? But what really worries me is when I install the Boinginator 3.0 or whatever they name it, about 3 days later after I get mine, they will announce that the Boinginator 4.0 will be coming out in August. And, you know, and then I'll be basically spending all my time saving up money to heal up from the 3.0 version and then to get the 4.0 version because it has a slightly better camera. But, you know, I mean, and then, of course, what do you do when you need to patch it. I mean, but if you do need to patch it, you better be sure and patch it. Well, we won't be here next week because of the Memorial Day holiday in the United States, so I will see you the week after. Thanks for watching, and that's the news. Thanks, Aaron, and I will see you next time on the Security Weekly News.